Welcome to episode 187 of the IOPN We Do Science podcast, the Institute of Performance Nutrition's podcast, and I'm the host, Dr. Laurent Vanek. Now, today we had a discussion about creatine. Creatine, you say, we've done this podcast before. Yes, and I've also done this topic with numerous guest experts over the years, and that does include today's guest, Dr. Scott Forbes from Brandon University in California. You'll be familiar with him if you're a regular. If not, catch up on previous episodes. Now, we're not just simply going back over old ground, although we will review some of the relevant evidence that pertains to the use of creatine monohydrate for various angles of training and performance. But the central question that we wanted to get into today was, what about endurance exercise? What about it, you say? Well, if you're into this topic, which all of you are, of course, you'll know that creatine is extremely well researched with huge amounts of evidence to support its use in strength training, gains in lean muscle mass, that sort of thing, but not so much in the endurance field. Although, of course, endurance athletes also need to undertake strength training, want to augment their carbohydrate fuel supplies and various other things. Anyway, we're going to get into this topic in great detail, and it adds to the body of knowledge out there and, of course, the various podcasts that we've done. So you can learn about those podcasts back at our website at www.theiopn.com. And whilst you're there, check out our online master's level diploma in sports nutrition, our professional development program, which is our unique community, resources, access to journals, that sort of thing. Learn about that at our website. And of course, our research and all the other things that we're doing and lots of new stuff on our website, all at www.theiopn.com. Now, here's my conversation with Dr. Scott Forbes. Enjoy. So welcome back to the Institute of Performance Nutrition's podcast. And I'm saying welcome back both to you, the listener, but also Dr. Scott Forbes. You must be up there with, I'm just trying to think now. I've interviewed so many people over the years, but I haven't interviewed most of those people more than once or twice. So this is where you're starting to go up my VIP rank, Scott.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm extremely happy to be here and happy to be back. So,
well, yeah, cool.
You've interviewed some phenomenal creatine researchers. So I feel very grateful to be on the podcast.
Well, it's time for you to rise to the challenge here, Scott. Let's see what happens. I mean, look, we're going to talk about creatine. No big surprise. Like you say, big researchers, your longtime colleague, Darren Kandow's been on, Eric Rawson, Craig Sale, and yourself, obviously. Now, I think it's safe to say we're not necessarily going to cover new ground as it relates to what creatine is. It's not suddenly this big new discovery. However, as I like to position a lot of these conversations around contextual considerations, we're trying to understand what these things are, mechanisms, tools in the toolbox, all that stuff. But a lot of this does come down to what we're actually trying to do in terms of outcomes. Our focus with this podcast is about bridging this gap between science and practice and ultimately helping practitioners make more informed decisions. And it's complex stuff in this world of sport and exercise, nutrition, and so on. But there's always cool stuff that comes up. It's a rapidly evolving field, and folks like yourself come up with new ways of looking at these things. And particularly when I think outside of the traditional creatine focus, which is strength, power, the usual stuff, and the stuff that we've talked about in great detail, and of course where a huge amount of literature has been published, although sport science, sport and exercise science, sports nutrition is relatively new compared to things like medicine and nursing and so on. Creatine's up there as being one of the most significantly studied substances as an ergogenic aid, et cetera. And we'll come back to that in a minute. But like I say, there are some different areas that come to interest, both for researchers and for us as practitioners, that I wanted to talk to you about, which is why I've asked you to come back, Scott. But before we do this, why don't you just give us a quick overview as to who you are and what you're doing? We've got lots of repeat listeners, of course, lots of of our loving fan base, geeks of sport and exercise nutrition, but there's lots of newbies too. So tell us who you are.
Absolutely. So I'm Dr. Scott Forbes. I'm an associate professor at Brandon University in the Department of Physical Education, which is located in Canada. Also an adjunct professor in the Faculty of Kinesiology and Health Studies at the University of Regina. And that's where the great legendary Dr. Darren Kandow is located. So I collaborate with him quite a bit and work with several of his students as well. So that's been a phenomenal relationship. Besides that, I'm a clinical exercise physiologist through our Canadian Society for Exercise Physiology and a high performance specialist, which is a kind of a new certification that they've started to offer. And I actually helped develop that certification. I have that. And then I've also completed the IOC diploma in sport nutrition, and I'm a certified sport nutritionist through the ISSN. So I have a few qualifications behind me, but really what I do is I'm an academic. So I teach in the area of exercise science and I conduct research.
So Scott, I guess the first thing that people are going to want to know is, of all the things that you could get into, now, of course, it's the rock star topic amongst protein and a few other things, but what got you into creatine research?
Yeah, so I was very fortunate to do my master's at the University of Saskatchewan with Phil Chilibeck. And he is one of the early kind of researchers that looked at creatine combined with resistance training in older adults and kind of pioneered that particular area of research. And Phil Chilibeck's PhD student was Dr. Darren Kandow. And I was doing my master's with Phil Chilibeck at that time. And so just basically, we started working on some creatine projects kind of early on in my research career and just developed that relationship with Darren and Phil and kind of continued on those projects until the present time. So yeah, so I still work with those guys very closely and been very fortunate. Basically, just kind of random chance to make that connection. But yeah, it's been awesome. And then the reason why I think it's so awesome is because creatine continues to be one of those supplements that can enhance a variety of different tissues within the body. So it's not just impacting muscle performance, but it can impact a variety of other tissues. And that's what really gets me excited about creatine.
I mean, there's so much to talk about, and we'll delve into those various areas. And then there's a particular couple of areas I wanted to focus on today that will add to the previous conversations I've had with you and those other researchers that we've just talked about. But just on a sort of a joking side of things, there's an interesting correlation amongst most of you researchers, and that is the lack of hair, if you don't mind my saying. What is going on there?
Yeah, absolutely. There was a study in rugby players where they showed an increased conversion of testosterone to dihydrotestosterone, or DHT. And DHT has been linked to male pattern baldness. So people always suggest that creatine causes baldness, although there is zero evidence to support that. But of course, myself, Dr. Darren Kandow, Phil Chilibeck, Jose Antonio, lots of the kind of creatine researchers around the world seem to lack hair. So maybe there is a connection. So maybe we need to kind of expand our research area and look at creatine and hair loss.
I think this is a classic correlation does not equal causation, Scott, type of conversation. Anyway, well, look, you only have to walk into a sports nutrition type store, a supplement store, a natural health store, where they'll tend to have a sort of fitness bodybuilding type section. And why would they do that? Well, because sports nutrition supplements are huge, absolutely massive industry around the world. Pretty much everywhere you'll find this stuff. Even in sort of very challenged economic climates, you're still going to see these types of products out there everywhere. And of course, lots of people are into health and fitness, and lots of people are wanting to get the most out of their training adaptations, whether it's for aesthetic purposes or whether it's for functional purposes for their sport or work, tactical athletes, that sort of thing. There's a whole lot of people here that are going to be interested in the potential that creatine can have for them. Do you want to just quickly summarize? This is sort of an impossible task to do within a matter of a few minutes, but just quickly summarize what creatine is, or specifically creatine monohydrate is, and what the best known reasons are for actually wanting to take it.
Yeah, absolutely. So that is an impossible task. So I'll try my best. But I think before I even talk about creatine, I think, as you mentioned, creatine can help some of the adaptations, but it's important to just exercise regularly, eat lots of fruits and vegetables and whole foods, and get lots of sleep. I think those are things that we can't ignore, and creatine is not going to fix. So it's a supplement. It's only going to have a small impact. It can have a positive impact, but you need to have a good foundation, and sleep, exercise, and eating real food is obviously kind of the foundation is required for optimal health. So I think that's important for the listeners to understand. So what is creatine? Creatine is, it's made up of three amino acids, and our bodies can synthesize creatine. So everybody has creatine within their bodies, but we can also get creatine from our diet. And it's primarily red meat and seafood. So if you're a vegetarian and you don't eat those, then you have lower amounts of creatine within your diet and also lower amounts of creatine within your body as well. We can also get creatine from a dietary supplement. So you can go to your supplement store and purchase creatine as well. So there's kind of three ways to get it. Once it gets into the bloodstream, about 95% of creatine is taken up into the muscle. And once it's in the muscle, about 2/3 gets converted into phosphocreatine. And phosphocreatine is like stored potential energy. So anytime you need to create energy quickly, or you're doing really intense exercise, you're going to utilize this particular energy system. But creatine can do a variety of other things too. It can help bring more glycogen into the muscle. So carbohydrates, again, another fuel. It could stimulate these satellite cells through different mechanisms. It can increase IGF-1. It can do all these other things in the muscle that's important for muscle health and muscle performance.
Yeah, and I mean, this is the thing that I find particularly interesting. And this is why I want to throw back in that term context. Relevance, by the way, is, you know, what is the relevance of this is my new buzzword, Scott. And, you know, you need to understand the strengths and limitations of said supplement or said training protocol or whatever. You obviously want to have some thoughts about what it is you're actually trying to achieve and then weigh up the cost and benefits of it all. And of course, one issue that comes with supplements is a lot of them don't do anything. Okay, a lot of them may do nothing, but also be safe, particularly if you're testing for banned substances, if that's important for you as a tested athlete. But some supplements actually can provide some assistance, but it depends on a number of things. And as you've already pointed out, there's a number of interesting areas with creatine. It's not just increasing strength or power. We need to dig deeper into that. How does that happen? And we're going to explore some of those things. But I do find it interesting that whether we're talking about supporting glycogen storage and potentially utilization to intramuscular buffering capacity, even potentially reducing inflammation, reducing reactive oxygen species. I mean, you know, preserving muscle mass in particularly interesting situations. I mean, that's just a few bits and pieces that we could get into. But some of those things are relevant and some of them aren't. And or there's a partnership involved, isn't it? You're not just taking creatine. So let's explore that a little bit before we get into the main topic, which is ultimately a different area of training and performance, which I think that creatine could have some great value to, as long as you understand the relevance and the context of it. But for the better known use of it, which is to assist with things like strength and power, let's just quickly get into that. I mean, how does creatine actually do this stuff?
So it provides your muscles with a little bit more capacity to create that high intensity energy. And so you can do a few more reps. And over time, it's been well established that creatine can enhance resistance training adaptation. So you can make your muscles bigger and stronger. And important, it's a benefit for young adults, and it's also a benefit for older adults as well. So that's kind of been some of the research for the last 10 or 20 years has shown that it's beyond just enhancing bodybuilders' physique and performance, but it's also a benefit for a variety of different population. So that's kind of the main mechanism, is just by enhancing training volume, is that you can, yeah, train a little bit harder and you can get bigger and stronger muscles over time. And then in that older population, we've also shown improvements in functionality. So we measure that by like sit to stand. So that's a functional test that you can perform. And there's improvements when you take creatine. So that's obviously a benefit for older adults. And sit to stand has been a surrogate marker for falls risk. So perhaps creatine can influence falls, although that research has never been done. And that would be a very difficult question to answer in the research world. But at least creatine can improve sit to stand performance. And that is a marker of falls risk.
So when we look at these things and we're going, right, okay, it's going to help me or my athlete become bigger, faster, stronger, the direct effects of consuming creatine is more to do with what happens when you store creatine, right, which is something I want you to explain in a minute. But the indirect effects, of course, are where it plays a partnership role in enabling adaptations to occur a certain way, and or, for want of being extremely basic, train a bit harder so that the training stimulus results in greater levels of stress, followed by potentially greater adaptations to that. Now, that's important because people, we got this thing, you take a pill, ibuprofen, aspirin, pain gone. Taking creatine doesn't mean bigger, faster, stronger, right? So do you want to just quickly explain the mechanisms of action just generally in that regard?
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, it increases your capacity to train, but you actually have to train harder to get the benefits of creatine. Creatine could also act through other mechanisms as well. So one thing is, particularly during the loading phase, it's actually going to bring water into the muscle cell, and that's going to cause the muscle cell to swell, and that's going to stimulate, it's called myogenic regulatory factors, and that increases satellite cells, and that increases the number of nuclei within the muscle. So muscle is myonucleated, which means it has multiple nuclei, and for the muscle to grow, it has to increase the number of nuclei first. So that's one thing that creatine can actually do, is increase these satellite cell that turn into nuclei, which increase the capacity for the muscle to grow. And then, as you mentioned, creatine has been shown to reduce inflammation and oxidative stress, and that could all influence recovery and adaptation as well. So there's lots of different mechanisms where creatine can work, particularly within the muscle cell.
So I think one thing that will start coming to mind, particularly for those that are plant-based or, you know, vegan or whatever, they're sitting there going, hang on, I don't eat meat, I don't eat fish, I'm absolutely not getting much, if any, creatine from my diet. I'm not entirely sure how much creatine my own body is making. How necessary is it for that creatine to be present? And how impactful is it by consuming a diet that is lower in these sources in their consideration of, well, should I maybe supplement this stuff? You know, there is that interesting question that they're going to ask themselves. Perhaps you could help them on that.
Yeah, for sure. Well, first of all, if you do eat meat, usually you have about 80% of your stores of creatine stores within your muscles. So even if you eat meat, you'll still respond to creatine, or most people respond to creatine, and they'll have about a 20% increase within their muscles, so following supplementation. Whereas vegans or vegetarians actually have lower amounts of creatine within their muscles. So they might have 60 or 70% of their total capacity that they can store within the muscle. And so they'll respond better to creatine supplementation. So there's been some good work by Dr. Darren Kando and Darren Burke and Phil Chilibeck, so that I mentioned previously, that looked at vegetarians versus omnivores. And they found that vegetarians respond better to creatine supplementation. So they got bigger and stronger muscles relative to omnivores. And it's mainly associated with that just lower baseline levels of creatine within their muscles. And that's also been shown by actually my PhD supervisor, Dr. Gordon Bell at the University of Alberta, and Dan Sirtak. They looked at responders and non-responders to creatine, and they found that responders had kind of two important characteristics. One, they had lower amounts of creatine within their muscles to begin with. So that's why we think vegetarians or vegans would respond better to creatine. And then the other factor was they actually had more type 2 muscle fibers. So the individuals that responded better to creatine had on average about 63% of their muscle fibers were fast twitch, whereas individuals that did not respond as well to creatine, they only had kind of in the mid-30s percentage of fast twitch fibers. So they had a lot more slow twitch fibers. So yeah, I definitely think that creatine could be a greater benefit for vegans or vegetarians.
Yeah, I have no doubts about that. You know, of course, people are thinking there, well, you know, do I need to eat meat and fish? And of course, we've discussed this many a time. You can get creatine from completely non-animal based sources. But we'll come back to that stuff when we talk about some practical stuff at the end of this podcast. But I just wanted to come back to this topic of responders and non-responders, because it's an interesting one. How do we define responders and non-responders in this context? Because I know, depending on how you look at that, there can be some rather positive or negative views of those terms. Do you want to just quickly explain what you meant by that?
Yeah, for sure. So this was with regards to their increase in the amount of creatine within their muscles. So that's how they identified responders and non-responders. But yeah, I think that term, you need to use that term very cautiously, because that doesn't mean that they might not respond to creatine in other capacities. So we know that creatine can impact, for example, bone tissue or brain health or heart health. And so to say that somebody's a non-responder to creatine based off that one measure or outcome measure is maybe not the best thing to do, because they might respond positively in other aspects. So I think we need to be very cautious when we use the term responders and non-responders.
Yeah, of course. And if we're saying, right, I want to get bigger, faster, stronger, and it doesn't happen, it may have nothing to do with the creatine. It might be that you're just not training right. And that's what I meant by, you know, there's a partnership consideration that we have to factor in. But also, whilst we're on this topic of responders and non-responders with the correct interpretation and definitions involved, the difference between how this stuff is generalized, of course, that has to be done with research. But, you know, we're dealing with individuals, and people come in all sorts of shapes and sizes, depending on what we're talking about, whether it's a training types and stimulus, but also nutritional needs will vary from individual to individual. What are the individual considerations for this, you think, in terms of responding and not responding from creatine supplementation?
Yeah, so obviously how much you get in your diet and your fiber type is probably kind of the two most important things. But yeah, there could be other things as well. There could be genetics, there could be the type of training that you're doing, and there's a lot of context that can go into it. We know that it can enhance resistance training adaptations, but whether it can enhance endurance adaptations or maybe high intensity interval training. So that's become kind of a popular trend in the research world and in the real world as well. A lot of people are doing HIIT training or Tabata type training, and creatine potentially could have a positive effect in that particular situation.
It just so happens that that's the area that I wanted to talk more about, Scott, because it's not just that we've done loads of podcasts already with you and the others about increasing muscle mass, increasing strength. There's undeniable evidence to support that reason for taking creatine monohydrate, irrespective of whether you consume meat, fish, or your plant-based. There's a good reason to take it, as long as you can, you know, after thinking this through, cost to benefit. And I don't, you know, the cost of the product's not that much. It's not a particularly expensive supplement, but there might be other considerations, which I think are rather interesting when we think about endurance athletes who, I mean, there's various kinds of endurance, obviously, but many of them will involve traveling, you know, great distances over a pretty significant amount of time, where weighing more than you might want to, having more muscle than you might want to, might be a consideration that is not necessarily beneficial to your endurance performance. But on the flip side, the event that you're participating in might have a sprint finish involved. You know, everyone might be able to keep up with each other right until the last 200 meters. And then that last sprint finish is actually what differentiates the podium and not non-podium athletes, is a different way of viewing some of this stuff, and or hill climbs or looking after one's bones off season through strength training. I mean, there's all sorts of considerations that I wanted to get in with you, but I know we've talked about in the past, and something I personally have found of great use for creatine, for example, in football or soccer players, is the use that creatine can have on carbohydrate storage, for example, particularly in tournament football scenarios. And this is most definitely not a conversation now about increasing strength and power, but we are talking about all the other different ways in which, you know, creatine can be of use. But I think centrally here is if we move away from, say, strength training or gaining bigger muscles or whatever, and we make this sort of person-centric, athlete-centric, that person does different things at different times. Now, yeah, okay, some people do the same thing in the gym week in and week out, but we're talking about athletes who will periodize their training. So depending on what they're doing and depending on what they're expecting to get from their training, the adaptations, will then start to influence whether they might want to consider some of this stuff. So let's just go back to endurance athletes, because that's an interesting area for you to get into, Scott. How did that come your way?
Yeah, so there's been a couple of recent papers examining creatine on either aerobic capacity or aerobic power, VO2 max, or just endurance performance. So one was done by Riza Bagheri, and they found actually that creatine was a detriment to VO2 max. I think the first author was Damien Grass on that particular paper. Interestingly, they actually showed that it reduced absolute VO2 max, but had no effect on relative VO2 max. And actually, in that particular paper, they showed that creatine might improve your ventilatory threshold. And so to me, if I was an endurance athlete, most endurance athletes, you want to improve your ventilatory threshold. That's probably the strongest predictor of endurance performance, particularly on the longer events. And so that got me thinking about, okay, well, maybe there's some context to this besides just looking at VO2 max, which I think was kind of the key kind of highlight in that particular paper, that it caused this detriment to VO2 max, even though I think there's lots of nuances to it. And then there is another paper that just came out by Sergey Ostojic. And again, it showed that creatine had no impact on endurance performance. Although if you look at that particular paper, they highlight that creatine could be a benefit for rowing performance. And it's more, they didn't try to synthesize it quantitatively. They just talk about it in the discussion. And so I've been kind of, maybe you influenced me in a great way, but you made me think about the importance of context and like nuances in the literature. And when I think about it, I think creatine overall isn't going to have a large impact on endurance performance. We know that your aerobic system, your ability to utilize oxygen, that's the predominant energy system that you're going to use when you're running these endurance events. But I think that creatine, where it could play a role, is where there's big changes in pace in a particular event, or as you mentioned, like the finishing kick. And so I started looking into the literature, and there's actually a few studies to show support of this. So there's a study in swimmers, they're doing a 400 meter race, and they found that the last 50 meters was performed faster when they took creatine. There was a study in cyclists where they did sprints every 10 kilometers, they did either 1 kilometer as fast as they could, and then 4 kilometers, and that alternated every 10 kilometers for 120 kilometers. And they showed in the last 1 kilometer and last 4 kilometers, that it was actually performed faster when they took creatine. And then there was another study where they did 30 minutes of kind of steady state exercise. And then they made them do intervals. So there's 5 15-second sprints with 45 seconds rest. They gave them 2 minutes of rest, and then they repeated that again. So they did another 5 15-second sprints with 45 seconds rest. And afterwards, they made them do another 30 minutes of steady state exercise. What they actually found was during the intervals, they performed 18% more work when they took creatine. So I think context is really important. And just throwing all the studies together into a meta-analysis, you're going to find nothing. You're going to say creatine doesn't work, or maybe even has a detrimental effect on VO2 max. But I think creatine can have a benefit in certain situations. And when you watch sporting events on TV, you see that there's like key moments in a race where somebody breaks away from someone like the pack, and you're like, how did they do that? Like, that was a big change of pace. And or they had a great finishing kick, and you're like, wow, how did they do that? That was a great thing. And maybe creatine could be a benefit in those situations.
Look, it's music to my ears, obviously, all of this. I think if you're in a position where, well, either you're a researcher and you happen to have been an athlete yourself, which is definitely not me, not really. But the other side of it, which is definitely where I've been, where I've seen the athletes train, not just perform, and across many different sports from, yes, strength, power, team sports, but I've worked a lot in endurance sports as well. And they do a lot of strength conditioning. There's all sorts of stuff. They have concerns about the integrity of their ligaments, joints. It's all the rage now, but bone health, preserving bone mass. I mean, there's all sorts of things, and there's various ways of approaching that through their training. And of course, that's the great thing about nutrition strategies and foods and supplements and so on, is that we can play a role in enabling these things to happen. And I think, yeah, if we simplify and generalize endurance athletes as just that, it's an oversimplification. And of course, when you apply that to research, that can be a very misleading thing. And I guess a great example of that is an assumption that an endurance event is, for example, a purely aerobic energy system based performance. No, it isn't. There's a mix of substrates being used, and there's a very good argument to manipulate the use of those different substrates. And it makes me think, actually, of if you look at elite. And by elite, I mean, you know, Olympic level marathon runners. That's a sprint. Okay, a couple hours sprint, roughly. But I mean, it's a sprint. If you go onto YouTube and you get members of the public to try and run at the same speed as some of these athletes, you know, they can't keep it up for more than a few minutes. So maybe let's just quickly talk about that and why that's relevant to this consideration for creatine.
Yeah, absolutely. So creatine is that important substrate for high intensity exercise. So anytime you're going above your VO2 max and really doing hard sprints or fast sprints, that's where this energy system becomes really important. So I think in races in the real world, they're not run at a perfectly steady pace. There's a change in paces that happen throughout the race or the finishing kick, which can influence it. Or in certain races, I went and got to watch a World Cup in Edmonton. It was for triathlon, and there was like a massive hill, so which is like integrated into the bike section of the course. I was like, whoa, man, like that's got to be brutal to climb up that hill, but that's definitely going to push them into that and above their anaerobic threshold and into anaerobic metabolism. And I think, you know, again, if you could have creatine to kind of help you out with that particular portion to create more muscular power, more muscular strength, that could be a benefit. But yeah, also, as you mentioned, I think if you're really concerned about creatine during the competitive season, maybe it could be a useful supplement during the off season to help build more strength, power, help out with recovery. And yeah, it can enhance bone tissue, bone health, particularly for endurance runners. That's a big concern.
Absolutely. And look, I mean, we haven't even talked about brain health and cognitive function and all those things, which we have talked about in other podcasts on this topic. But again, just coming back to this, because it's such a a muscle-centric conversation whenever we talk about creatine. But the other side of this, which I think is very interesting, particularly as it relates to endurance performance or adaptations to training that impacts endurance performance, is the impact that this can have on neuromuscular activity and buffering capacity. Do you want to just talk about that? Because this is an area that isn't often discussed.
Yeah, so another kind of positive effect of creatine is that it's going to reduce hydrogen ions, so it can act as an intracellular buffer, which could be a benefit for high-intensity exercise because we know those hydrogen ions are, those are the bad guys. It's not lactate. It's not lactic acid. It's the hydrogen ions that are really causing kind of all the detriment within the muscle. They're slowing muscle contraction. They're impairing anaerobic glycolysis through slowing down phosphofructokinase, kind of the rate-limiting enzyme in glycolysis. But yeah, so that's kind of another mechanism of creatine and how it can actually improve kind of exercise performances through that buffering capacity. And that's, I think, often not cited as kind of one of the mechanisms of creatine, but we know during endurance performance that becomes a problem in the last kind of finishing sprint of a race, for example. That's where you feel your legs really burning, or if you're getting close to or just above your threshold, you start to accumulate these hydrogen ions. And again, if you have a greater buffering capacity, then perhaps you can perform better. So there's other supplements that might also influence buffering capacity. And traditionally, those show improvements in endurance performance because of that particular mechanism.
Yeah, and that's great. And I find that to be another great argument for considering creatine supplementation in endurance. Now, obviously, we're talking about people who are maybe not necessarily at the elite end of the spectrum, although they most definitely would want to do this or consider it, but those that are looking at least to push their own boundaries and, as you say, dip in and out of their various thresholds is where this is an interesting consideration. And you've already talked about VO2 kinetics. We've talked about ventilatory threshold, which is another great argument here and will be music to exercise physiologists, of course. But what about the mitochondria itself? You know, we talk about mitochondria being sort of the powerhouse, the factory for energy production. But also when we do talk about things like endurance, capacity, substrate utilization, particularly fat oxidation, for example, we start to get a bit more interested in mitochondrial function. Mitochondrial biogenesis, for example, is an argument that people will talk about training low carbohydrate, for example, because that stimulates mitochondrial biogenesis. What's the role that creatine can have on this, and why would that be of benefit then?
Yeah, so I think it has a very small role, if any. As I mentioned, that one meta-analysis actually showed a reduced whole body oxygen capacity with creatine supplementation. But there is some mechanistic data to suggest that creatine might have positive effect. So one is it could actually help once the ATP is formed in the mitochondria, it can help transport that ATP from the mitochondria to where the contractile components within the muscle. So that potentially could be a benefit and actually enhance ATP utilization, but the actual evidence in humans is lacking to support that. There is some studies in animal models to show an increase in mitochondrial biogenesis with creatine, perhaps by enhancing exercise capacity and leading to further adaptations. But in humans, that data is definitely lacking. Yeah, there's definitely some positive kind of animal mechanistic theories to why creatine could actually be of benefit to the mitochondria.
Yeah, great. So maybe further down the road, we might learn something. But for now, that's not really a consideration we should be putting too much time and effort into. So we go back to this muscle-centric conversation. And of course, muscles are made up of muscle fibers. And on a very basic level, we would differentiate fast twitch and slow twitch muscle fibers. Now, to an endurance athlete, they might find themselves being attracted to endurance because they're just genetically distribution of fiber types that sort of made them a little bit more likely to become endurance athletes. But of course, one of the great things about training adaptations is you can have an impact on some of this. What are the sort of things that the literature shows and your own research has shown as it relates to creatine and muscle fiber type and or increasing or changing muscle fiber types in certain kinds of athletes?
Yeah, so we know for sure that endurance training shifts fiber types from fast twitch to slow twitch. It makes your muscles more oxidative. And there was a really cool study. It was actually done at the University of Alberta. That's where I did my PhD, by Ted Putman. And they had animals and they used what's called low chronic frequency stimulation. So essentially they use electrical activity and it zaps the rat and that causes a muscle contraction. They do this at a very kind of low intensity and they do it for long periods of time. So that's kind of simulating endurance training or endurance activity where you're contracting your muscles, not at a maximum intensity, and you're doing it for long periods of time. Although in these animal models, it was really extreme. So they were actually doing this for 12 hours a day. And what they found was that's a very potent model to cause that shift in fiber type from a fast twitch to slow twitch. But interestingly, is they gave these rats or half the rats creatine. And what they found was that that chronic low frequency stimulation still increased oxidative capacity in those rats receiving creatine, but it also helped to preserve the fast twitch components or characteristics of the muscle. So to me, I was like, when I read that, I was like, oh, this could be really cool for endurance athletes that are performing lots of endurance training, like a high volume training camp. If you took creatine as well, you're still going to get the benefits of that high volume training, but you'll also preserve your fast twitch characteristics of your muscles. So you can still perform those high intensity bursts of activity. And again, maybe you can sprint a little bit faster than another athlete that wasn't consuming creatine. So again, that's in animals, so we need to replicate that in humans. But when I read that particular paper, I thought, okay, the context of why this might be important. And I think for endurance athletes, particularly during a high volume training camp, it could be a benefit.
Actually, you just raised an interesting point that I've talked about with many researchers on this podcast is the issue in research which comes up with who have these experiments actually been done on? Is it humans? Is it males? Is it females? Is it young, old? Because there are differences, particularly if we're going to try and translate that into practice or at least information that's relevant to inform practice or decisions or whatever. In this area and in these studies that not just your own research that you've done in the lab, but when you're doing like meta-analyses, reviews, that sort of thing, how much do you take into account animal-based studies on this? And is there a value to that? And if so, why?
Yeah, so I think in the creatine world, you need to be extremely cautious because animals metabolize creatine differently than humans, particularly in the brain, but in other tissues as well. So we need to be very cautious with using animal models. So I'm an applied exercise scientist. So I think we need to run these studies on humans to really find out the answer if creatine could be a benefit. But I think those animal models can be useful to provide some mechanisms. And as I mentioned, like it was a really extreme model that was used in the animal model. I don't think any human wants to exercise for 12 hours a day. And they definitely should not if they want to maximize performance. But you can utilize those models to kind of show proof of concept. And so I think those models are very effective. But yeah, I think we need to do those studies in humans and we need to be very cautious with translating animal creatine research to humans.
Yeah, no, thanks for that. I always raise these topics because we're interested in evidence-based practice or evidence-informed practice. And you just got to be mindful where this stuff came from. And a lot of research, particularly sports nutrition research, is it might be done on humans, but for example, it's done on college students and not necessarily elite athletes, not wanting to smash any dreams there for anyone, but there is a big difference between a college athlete and an Olympic athlete, for example. An NBA basketball player is not the same thing as, you know, your college basketball player. So look, one thing that is really important in one's consideration of nutrition strategies, diet, supplements, etc., as it pertains to getting the most out of your training, getting the most out of your adaptations, is this whole topic of recovery. And recovery is big, and of course there's many angles there, including things like sleep and all these other things. And of course this is a place also for creatine. What sort of roles does creatine play in the concept of recovery, and what sort of benefits are likely to occur as a result of that?
Yeah, so there's definitely evidence to show that even following endurance activity, like running a 30-kilometer race, that there's a reduction in inflammation in the muscle, and there's also a reduction in oxidative stress. But I think we need to be, again, cautious with regards to just interpreting that data as enhancing recovery. And I think we need to do more research to really show if creatine can speed up recovery or enhance recovery. We do know that if creatine is consumed while performing like a high intensity training program, that could benefit that particular training program. So it can help with adaptations, but perhaps that's by actually allowing them to do more work, train a little bit harder, and get kind of further benefits. So there's some great research by Jeff Stout and Chrissy Kendall showing that creatine combined with high intensity interval training can enhance, for example, ventilatory threshold. But whether creatine can actually impact recovery and speed up recovery is actually, from my knowledge, kind of less known. And I'm not too sure that there's a huge amount of evidence to support that besides manipulating kind of some of these factors acutely, like reducing inflammation or oxidative stress over the short term.
Yeah, no, well, that's very useful. And look, I think when we start talking about things like creatine, a lot of this has just got to come down to, yeah, we can argue the strengths and limitations. We can get all very theoretical about this. But what about research that's actually done on important performance-related metrics, you know, things like time to exhaustion, time trial performances, that sort of thing? I know you've already talked about some of this indirectly, but what do the studies show in that regard?
Yeah, so there is some evidence that it can enhance time to exhaustion, but as we know, most performance races out there are not time to exhaustion races. They're actually time trials. And the evidence to enhance time trials is quite limited. So there is no strong evidence that creatine can actually enhance time trial performance. But I think what we need to do, and I think the reason why there's actually no evidence to support that, is because a lot of the things that we do or performance metrics in the lab don't actually simulate what actually happens out in the real world, where there is that change of pace or there is that big finishing kick. And I think if we do that, then there might be some benefits to creatine to actually enhance performance. So yeah, you are right that there are different metrics, different tools to measure performance. And yeah, I think we need to do better jobs as researchers to really try to simulate what's happening out in the real world.
Yeah, that's the problem with doing research though, isn't it? To bridge that gap between the lab and the real world is complicated stuff. I mean, albeit impossible in many different ways. So that's why you have to piece everything together, don't you? And that requires a fair bit of critical thinking and all that stuff. But look, from your perspective, you've been in this world for a long time as it relates to creatine research. I know it's not the only thing that you do, but it, you know, you are one of relatively few people out there that have immersed yourself very deeply into this. We've talked about some health, some performance aspects of this, both in this podcast and previous podcasts. But what we're focusing on here is endurance performance. And yes, there's different kinds of endurance performance, different kinds of endurance athletes, of course. But from a practical application perspective, from what we know, and by we, I mean what the research evidence tells us, what are the main sort of potential practical applications? What are the recommendations you can offer us at this point that we should seriously consider?
Yeah, so I think that creatine could definitely be of impact to endurance performances where there's a lot of change in pace, where there's that finishing kick that's required. I think we need to look at the actual dose of creatine that's required to enhance adaptations. So traditionally, you would perform that loading phase, which is 20 grams per day. But we know if you do that loading phase, that it also brings a lot of water into the muscle cell as well, which is important to stimulate muscle growth over time. But that increase in water retention can actually increase body weight. And I think we need to be cautious of that as kind of providing that to endurance athletes. So maybe there's ways to minimize that. And I think we need to conduct more research in that area to see if maybe a lower dose of creatine, just taking 3 or 5 grams a day, could actually get some of the benefits of creatine. We know that it can saturate your muscles with creatine. It just takes a little bit longer. And maybe you'll actually have a little bit less water in the muscle cell over time as well, and less body weight gain. So that's one theory or speculation that we have. So that's one suggestion or practical application of creatine for endurance athletes. The other thing is we need to do kind of a better job of looking at females, particularly across the menstrual cycle. So Abby Smith-Ryan has done some recent work in that area and showing that creatine can influence water retention and body weight differently across the menstrual cycle. But I think we need to do more research in that area. And then we know that creatine combined with carbohydrates can be a benefit for endurance athletes by not only increasing creatine uptake, but also glycogen uptake as well. So again, that could be a benefit for endurance athletes as well. So we need to kind of do more research in all those areas to really kind of pull it all together and see if creatine can really impact endurance performance.
That's great, Scott. And, you know, knowledge is power. I know creatine helps increase strength and power, and creatine knowledge helps to increase our power in this regard. And no joking aside, though, it's just interesting to have these conversations, because you wouldn't normally think about creatine and endurance, but perhaps you would now, the listener, the researcher, the practitioner, the endurance athlete. And we've already discussed quite a few reasons why it should be considered as something you might want to put into your toolbox of options off season, on season, and so on. And there's no doubt that there's still much more to learn. And thanks to you and, you know, all the researchers out there that are continuing to contribute to the body of knowledge on this, I'm sure we'll have more podcasts, more opportunities to discuss where we're at in the coming years. But I just wanted to thank you for your time, Scott. As always, it's you know your stuff, obviously, but you're good at translating this and explaining stuff. So I appreciate it. I learned a few things myself, so that was good. And looking forward to having you back.
Happy to be here as always. And yeah, thank you very much for the opportunity. And as mentioned earlier, I think you've also stimulated my mind as well with regards to context and nuances. And I think that's important to kind of pull out from the literature as well.
Well, I do. I try. I try. Well, look, thank you. That was great. And I look forward to bringing another episode of We Do Science back to you all very soon. Take care, everyone.